Okay, let's think about some of the apps and websites that are really popular these days. People who need a place to stay use Airbnb and they share a person's home. People who need a ride might use Uber and they share space in someone else's car. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley recently visited a company in the Netherlands that allows people to share things like power drills and bicycle pumps.
It isn't surprising that the idea for the borrowing platform Peerby originated in one of the world's most densely populated countries, the Netherlands. At the Amsterdam headquarters of Peerby, which stands for Peer-to-Peer Nearby, founder Dan Verpol says he had the idea for the startup after his house burned down and he had to borrow everything. At first, he says he felt dependent, but then realized people generally like helping each other because it creates a bond.
People are social animals. We like to help each other out. Borrowing things is probably one of the oldest behaviors in nature, and we are just making it easier through technology. So we created a platform that makes it easy for people to find that neighbor that's willing to lend what they need.
Peerby hooks up 100,000 borrowers and lenders a month in the Netherlands. The company is also active throughout Belgium and in Berlin and London. Amsterdam native Cindy Bakum is a regular user.
Last time I had a friend over and we were watching a movie on his laptop, but he forgot his adapter and my adapter didn't fit. So I put out a request. It was actually my neighbor. He really lived on my block and he had an adapter so we could finish watching the movie. So that worked very well.
The sharing economy is booming. Some estimates put the peer-to-peer rental market in the billions. Herman Keinheis's firm Sonoma Ventures is an investor in Peerby.
We see that more and more consumers start to realize that access to stuff is actually cheaper, more convenient, and greener than ownership.
Access over ownership may be gaining fashion, says venture capitalist Guillaume Lautour, but to really change people's habits, a company has to have scale. Lautour says there are other borrowing sites, and size will make the difference between profitability and failure.
It's a kind of service where you need enough liquidity to be really efficient. You need hundreds of thousands of things to lend or borrow.
Lautour points to the success of eBay, which he says works because it is global, not local. Peerby will launch in 50 U.S. cities in 2015, where it hopes to build scale and become a household name in borrowing. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News.
The FCC is a small agency with a big impact on our daily lives. Just a few things it's considering these days: how to regulate the internet, whether to allow people to use cell phones while flying, and whether to let Comcast take over Time Warner Cable. As NPR's Brian Naylor reports, all of this puts pressure on the agency's chairman, former cable TV lobbyist Tom Wheeler.
When Tom Wheeler agreed to President Obama's request to lead the FCC, it's doubtful he imagined mornings like the one last November.
Which side are you on, Tom?
Which side are you on?
A small group of activists blocked the driveway of his Georgetown townhouse, holding a banner that said, "Save the Internet." Wheeler tried to engage the group, but eventually gave up and took public transportation to work. The activists want the FCC to regulate the internet like a public utility, such as the phone company. That's what President Obama wants, too. Big media companies, on the other hand, such as Netflix and Amazon, want to be able to cut deals with other big companies like Comcast and Verizon to ensure their content gets priority. Wheeler is trying to strike that balance. Here he is in a speech to the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council last year.
Never in the life of anyone in this room has there been greater opportunity to exploit the new networks for ownership diversity and content diversity. And that's what makes the open internet so damn important.
The net neutrality debate has certainly made Wheeler more of a public figure than many of his predecessor FCC chairs. Wheeler previously headed both the National Cable Television Association and the Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association. That led HBO's John Oliver to say putting Wheeler in charge of the agency that regulates those industries was akin to having a dingo watch your baby, to which Wheeler responded,
"I would like to state for the record that I'm not a dingo."
Former FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell.
There is a tremendous amount of pressure applied to the FCC from many different quarters. It could be the public, it could be Congress, it could be the media, it could be think tanks and various pressure groups from both the left and the right.
McDowell, who dealt with Wheeler before he became FCC chair, says the pressure doesn't faze Wheeler.
Tom Wheeler is a very strong-willed individual. He has a clear vision of where he wants to go, and he will pursue that vision vigorously, much to the consternation of his opponents and adversaries.
Net neutrality is not the only issue facing Wheeler and the FCC. In December, the commission approved a plan he backed to help more schools and libraries afford high-speed internet connections by raising fees on Americans' phone bills. And there are the contentious issues of cell phones on planes and the merger of the big cable companies. Nicole Turner-Lee is vice president of the Minority Media and Telecommunications Council.
I think he's got a full plate with a lot of entrees that he has to sort of sort through.
Turner Lee has met with Wheeler on the net neutrality issue and hopes he'll allow an open internet that does not give preferential treatment to big media companies while increasing access to minority communities.
He listened to us the same as he listened to the protesters that were sitting on his lawn. I think we're dealing with a chairman that gets this.
And reaching that balance between industry, special interest groups, and consumers may be Wheeler's biggest challenge. Brian Naylor, NPR News.
The internet has connected us to faraway people and places, allowed us to share information from around the world. Oh, and it also gave us...
Johnny, that really hurt! Is this real life?
Evolution of dance.
Double rainbow, oh my God.
My
Leave Britney alone!
What does the fox say?
Remember those? I'd like to forget what did the fox say in particular. So we're here to bring you the best of this past year's internet with the help from Sean Ramesvaram. He's a producer at Studio 360 and hosts the pop culture podcast Sideshow. Thanks for being with us.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You recently did an episode on Sideshow where you asked different people to come up with their favorite video, song, website from the last year. Let's tick through a few of these, starting with
sure.
A music video by Sia. I love this, by the way. The song is called Chandelier. So tell us a little bit about this. What caught people's imagination about this video?
It's this 8-year-old, 9-year-old looking girl in this blonde wig just dancing frenetically all over this sort of like shoddy looking apartment. It's simple, and yet the dance is incredible and so powerful, and it perfectly matches this song. And it's well on its way to 500 million views, and
incredible.
Rightfully so. The music video is alive and well and arguably doing better than it ever has before, thanks to YouTube.
Also on this list, there is a website called See Here Party. So I am bringing this up now. Tell
yes.
me how this works.
Yeah, so I'll explain it, but it's something that you truly need to experience to fully understand. But basically, you go to the site, it asks you to enter tags of anything. So my favorite things that I would put in are pizza,
Here
you know,
go.
Puppies, and maybe The Simpsons, for example.
Pizza, puppies, and The Simpsons. I'm
yeah.
typing that
so
in right now. Okay.
You punch in those tags, and then you click next, and then you're asked to select a song. And of course, for me, I would just punch in Drake and take any one of his many hits.
And,
then
says,
it asks you if you want a party.
And we want a party.
You definitely want a party.
Okay, so what I'm seeing now is like these unbelievably crazy gifts of just like the Simpsons and puppies under a tree in various extremely strange outfits. This really feels like very hallucinogenic. A lot of fun. I like it.
It's like instead of like back in the day, if you went to a really great party where there was like this really interesting video collage on being projected on some wall, now you can just make it yourself in 3 seconds thanks to this site. It's truly a gift.
There's also the 11-minute TV sitcom parody, Too Many Cooks.
It takes a lot to make a stew.
A pinch of salt and laughter too.
Right, yeah, this was probably the most viral video of the year, at least one that was satirical and really, really smart. It's this 11-minute take on the opening credit sequences and TV cheese from, like, basically the 80s onward. It debuted on Adult Swim in late October, but it was randomly uploaded by the guy who made it to YouTube and then, like, went just bananas. And what sets it apart from the competition is its density. Like, most viral videos have a few notes and, you know, they're like 2 minutes long and then you watch it once and you get the point. But Too Many Cooks dares to achieve more and it really rewards repeat viewings. It's amazing.
Sean Ramaswaram, he is the host of the pop culture podcast Sideshow. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know how it goes. You're getting a little older, your memory starts to go, you forget where you put the car keys or whether you turned off the oven, and you can't remember what happened to all that telemetry data you collected while exploring the surface of Mars. All right, you might not experience that last one, but NASA's Mars rover Opportunity is experiencing what NASA scientists are calling amnesia. Opportunity has been on the planet's surface for more than a decade. That's pretty old in rover years, and it's having problems with one of its memory banks. When the rover tries to save data to that faulty bank, the data gets lost, or worse, it reboots and forgets the commands NASA has been sending it. NASA's working on a software hack to make the rover ignore the defective memory bank, and once they get it fixed, they're hoping Opportunity can hold on just a little bit longer before it bites the red dust. The project manager told Discovery News that some of Opportunity's most important explorations could be just ahead in the Marathon Valley. The Marathon Valley, by the way, is named that because the rover will have rolled more than 26.2 miles across Mars if it makes it. Not bad for an old fella. Solar energy had a banner year in 2014. As more and more U.S. households make their own electricity with solar panels, they're paying less to electric utilities, and that's making the utilities a little nervous. In some states, those companies are fighting back. Lauren Summer of member station KQED and Dan Boyce of member station KUNC tell us how sunny California and Colorado are handling the rise of solar.
There's a quiet war going on. A slow, simmering battle between electric utilities and solar companies.
You probably haven't noticed this clash because it's happening one house at a time. Example, Barb Gifford and her husband Don Duggar are standing out in front of their place in Boulder, Colorado.
And they're watching the installation of their new rooftop solar system.
These are the kind of days in Colorado you go, oh my gosh, we should have solar. Because it's sunny, it's bright, it's blue.
For Don and Barb, the time feels right because solar has gotten a lot cheaper in the last few years.
Definitely cut our dependency on Xcel down dramatically by doing it that way.
Xcel Energy is their utility. Duggar thinks these panels could provide 80% of the power they use. That's power they won't have to buy from Xcel.
In fact, Xcel has to buy excess power from them.
That's a concern.
Xcel VP of Policy and Strategy, Frank Prager.
That's why we're trying to address it today before it gets to be too big a concern.
Let's explain for a second. If you put solar panels on your roof, most likely you're still going to be hooked up to the traditional electric grid. So you can still turn on the TV if the sun isn't shining.
But if the sun is shining, most state laws require your utility to pay you for any extra power you're feeding back onto the grid. And in California, it's starting to add up.
We have far and away the most customer solar.
That's Jonathan Marshall, a spokesman for Pacific Gas and Electric, which is the major utility in Northern California. It's home to a quarter of all the rooftop solar systems in the country.
And Marshall says with such low bills, solar customers aren't paying their share of keeping up the electric grid.
In fact, they use the grid more than almost anyone because they're selling power back into it.
So PG&E and California's two other major utilities are proposing a big change to make up lost revenue.
A fixed monthly charge that everyone would pay. $10 a month, $120 a year. The fee may not sound like much, but to solar companies, it's a direct attack.
Investor-owned utilities across the country are fighting rooftop solar.
That's Sanjay Ranchod of Solar City, the largest solar company in both California and Colorado.
He says the extra fee would make solar a harder sell for his company.
For a company that has depended on a monopoly, competition from Solar City or any other solar company is scary.
He says it also makes solar less attractive at a time when states are trying to encourage renewable energy.
UC Berkeley economist Severin Borenstein says this whole debate shows solar is a disruptive technology, kind of like cell phones were to landlines.
I think there's a big question in the electricity industry right now about what will happen to utilities and what their business model will be 10 or 20 or 30 years from now.
There's actually a name for the way solar is cutting into the utility business model.
The death spiral.
The more customers go solar, the more revenue utilities lose, so they have to raise prices to make it up.
But higher prices entice even more customers to go solar,
which creates a cycle
spiraling out of control. Borenstein says that's why utilities may need to consider a new business model. Instead of being power companies, they could become electric grid companies,
where they don't actually bring electricity in, they just shuffle it around between one house and another.
At Don Duggar and Barb Gifford's house in Colorado, they actually feel defiant about it, like the writing's on the wall.
Xcel either changes to match technology or they're going to get left behind.
In states with a lot of solar, that struggle is already playing out. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Sommer in San Francisco.
And I'm Dan Boyce in Denver.
President Obama said last month that the U.S. would respond to the hack attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment in the place, time, and manner of his choosing. With an executive order signed yesterday, the president has taken the first steps, imposing new sanctions on North Korea, which the FBI blames for the attack. We're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith with more on the response. Tamara, what can you tell us about these new sanctions?
This is the first time the U.S. government has imposed sanctions because of a cyber attack on a private company. But U.S. officials who spoke on condition of anonymity said North Korea, quote, crossed a threshold here with the hacking of Sony Pictures, and the sanctions are meant to signal that cyber attacks will not be tolerated. They also say that this was just among a series of provocations from North Korea. The sanctions target three entities and 10 individuals, and they say that these folks didn't have any direct involvement with the hacking, but that the sanctions are targeting the North Korean government and, in particular, its defense industry. These people and entities will not be able to do business with U.S. firms or financial institutions. And the executive order the president issued also leaves a lot of room for additional sanctions.
And remind us why the administration is adding these new sanctions against North Korea.
Sony Pictures had their systems hacked, and the FBI says North Korea was behind that attack. Now, some cybersecurity experts have cast doubt on that, but U.S. government officials made it clear in announcing these sanctions that they stand by the assessment that North Korea was at fault.
All because of the movie The Interview.
The Interview, a bromance.
Tamara, are these mostly symbolic sanctions? I mean, North Korea is already under significant sanctions.
Significant. There have been four UN Security Council resolutions adopted since 2006, as well as two U.S. sanctions programs. These are largely targeted at North Korea's weapons development, nuclear weapons development. So you could easily argue that these new sanctions are just piling on to a pretty big pile already. U.S. officials insist, though, that these are new and different because they name 10 individuals, most of whom work for the country's main arms dealer. They say that this is, naming them is going to make it very hard for those people to do business basically anywhere in the world. The White House also says that there are more sanctions yet to come.
And some sanctions are targeting North Korea's military intelligence units. That could be more than symbolism.
It could be, except it seems highly unlikely that anyone in U.S. financial institutions is doing business with the North Korean intelligence agency either.
Tamara, the White House press secretary, says this is just the first phase of the response. I mean, does that mean the U.S. wasn't responsible for those internet outages in North Korea in recent weeks?
It's not entirely clear. U.S. officials were asked about that, and one U.S. official, speaking anonymously, said he wouldn't comment on the North Korean internet outage, and then went on to say that it's even possible they did it to themselves.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.